So the title of today's talk is On the Arising of the Bodhicitta. Very simple. So yesterday I spoke about my personal response to the Bodhisattva ideal, especially my response to Bhante's lectures on the Bodhisattva ideal, and most especially of all to his lecture, The Awakening of the Bodhi Heart. I was just completely thrilled by that lecture. And I found it particularly thrilling to hear his description of the Bodhicitta as a transcendental force, as it were, the force of wisdom and compassion erupting in the world, taking one over, taking individuals over, to bring about the liberation, the enlightenment of all beings. For some reason, I really resonated with that. Something deep within me responded to that. It wasn't as if he was talking about something completely foreign, as it were. It was something I felt, as it were, familiar with, even though it was so unusual. And I think it's important to notice this. Notice our responses to the Dharma. You're all here because you've responded to the Dharma. It's very important to notice our resonances with the Dharma. There is already something of the Bodhicitta within us. It's not a completely distant, completely foreign element, as it were. There is the potentiality for the arising of the Bodhicitta in us all. In the Shiksha Samuchaya, or the Compendium of Discipline, which is a compendium of choice extracts from Buddhist sutras, Mahayana sutras, Shantideva quotes from a sutra, I'm not sure which one it is, which describes the Bodhicitta very feelingfully, in a very sort of homely and humble way, the Bodhicitta as like the cry of a little sparrow chick as it starts to break through the eggshell. Apparently a little chick inside the shell, little sparrow shell, is going deep, deep, or something like that. I'm not sure. Bird people will tell me what it sounds like, but it makes a little cry. So the Buddha says, even so, Manjushri, a bodhisattva wrapped in the membrane of ignorance, although still holding the wrong view of a fixed self, still fixed in the world, utters the cry of a Buddha, the cry of emptiness, unconditioned and unfettered. I like that. The cry of emptiness, unconditioned and unfettered. So we're like these little baby, tiny sparrows, just inside our shells of ignorance, and we're crying, Buddha, Buddha, empty, empty. Bodhicitta, Bodhicitta, Bodhicitta. I really like that. So there is something in us that responds to Bodhicitta. And if we're going to develop Bodhicitta, we need to recognise that response, cherish that response, and not allow anything to suppress that response, that cry of longing for the Buddha, that cry, that little faint cry of Bodhicitta. Probably the greatest act of violence that one could do to oneself and to others is to reject our potential for Bodhicitta. If you reject it in yourself, it means that you do not only deny yourself great benefit, but you'll deny others great benefit as well. It's said that the worst thing a bodhisattva can do is to renounce his bodhicitta. So in the same way, on our level, the greatest act of violence that we could do to ourselves is to eschew, to ignore, to suppress, to be violent to the potential for bodhicitta in ourselves. A great 19th century Tibetan Lama named Patril Rinpoche, who was incredibly influential on the whole course of modern Tibetan Buddhism, especially in the Nyingma school, and who was generally regarded as a bodhisattva, points out that all beings have the potential for bodhicitta. And he actually points to why all beings have the potential for bodhicitta. He says, well, all beings are at some level aware, and they're able to concentrate. They have to be, even animals have to be, even insects, he says, in order to survive. They have to be aware in order to survive. Obviously, this is very, very rudimentary awareness indeed. But, you know, if you've ever seen an animal, you ever see the bunnies on the lawn, the rabbits on the lawn, you know, their ears suddenly go up when they're always aware of danger. There is a rudimentary awareness there. And Pātara Rinpoche also says that very few beings don't possess an instinctive protective compassion for their young. Well, you see it, don't you, when an animal's young are in danger, how there's this instinctive response from the mother or the father sometimes. So Pātara Rinpoche says that this means that all beings show signs, although very distant, signs of love and compassion for all. There's some awareness and there's some love and compassion. Well, if that's true of all creatures, and no doubt you could spend the whole study group discussing whether that was true, and that might not get you anywhere, certainly human beings must possess a far greater potential. We are possessed not just of ordinary sense awareness, we possess reflexive awareness. We can reflect on our experience. We can see, for example, that our actions have consequences, that we can affect people for the good or for ill, for that matter. We can see the effect we have on others. We can also, we have this wonderful, extraordinary ability which we can develop. We can identify with others. We can imaginatively feel what others feel. We can do this reflection. Well, I want to avoid pain and suffering, and I want to be happy. That's what I want in life. Well, if I'm like that, well, everybody else is like that. Nobody wants to suffer. Nobody wants to be in pain. Everybody wants to be happy. They might be going about it in all sorts of weird and wonderful ways, but that's basically what they want. So we have this wonderful thing, this reflexive self-awareness. Very often in Buddhist texts, you have these meditations, these reflections on the preciousness of human existence, the preciousness of being born as a human being. What that really means, I think, is reflecting on the miracle of self-awareness, of reflexive awareness. It really is an extraordinary thing. It's one of those miracles that we overlook, we just take for granted, but it really is the seed of, in fact, wisdom and compassion, the seed of bodhicitta. The bodhicitta is there as a seed, as potential, and spiritual practice is about cultivating that, developing that to the fullest possible level. Bhante, in a little booklet, a transcription of a lecture that he gave at a conference of mystics and scientists many years ago, one of many writings that people don't pay very much attention to, a lecture called The Bodhisattva, Evolution and Self-Transcendence. Bhante speaks of the bodhicitta as the bodhisattva principle at work in every form of existence, from the lowest to the most lofty. It's the urge to enlightenment is imminent in all forms and spheres of life, from the humblest to the highest, and manifests whenever a kind and intelligent action is performed. So the bodhisattva principle, the bodhicitta, manifests whenever a kind and intelligent action is performed. I think this is incredibly significant, in a way very ordinary, very simple, but very important to reflect upon, I think. The bodhisattva principle, the potential for bodhicitta, manifests whenever a kind and intelligent action is performed. So kindness and intelligence. So look for that in yourselves. Notice, recall your acts of ordinary kindness, even your acts of extraordinary kindness. Recall your acts of intelligence. Recall your kindness and awareness, for that is where the seed of bodhicitta is to be found. Look for these qualities in yourselves. And in that way, we can strengthen, you can strengthen them and deepen them. It might be, in fact, worthwhile in your groups just spending a bit of time recalling briefly and sharing with one another your experiences of acts of kindness and intelligence. It might be well worth doing that. Maybe not spend very long, maybe it's up to you, but might be worth just raising that, bringing that up, bringing that into focus. So it's so important to recognise that we have the potential for these things. Sometimes, you know, Buddhist texts describe the spiritual ideal, describe the bodhisattva and the bodhicitta in such profound and cosmic and, you know, overwhelming terms. We can think, well, we're nowhere near it. But whatever description of the profundity of enlightenment, it's always pointed out that we have a resonance with that. We have the potential for that. The qualities are there in us in seed form. Now, it's the arising of the bodhicitta utpada, as it's called, bodhicitta utpada, that makes one a bodhisattva. That's when the aspiration towards wisdom and compassion has decisively taken you over. And the texts make it clear that this is a momentous event. It's a real turning point in one's life. It doesn't mean, it seems, that after that everything's going to be smooth and easy. But something has happened that has changed you very deeply, very profoundly. Shantideva in the Bodhicharyavatara, the entry into the Bodhisattva's life, describes it no less as a spiritual rebirth. He says, "Today my birth is completed. My human nature has borne fruit. Today I have been reborn into the Buddha family, and I am now a son of the Buddha. And now I must live up to that family's tradition in order that there may be no stain placed on that pure family." He's a different being now, part of a different family and a different lineage. This is very resonant. It would have great significance in India, of course, where, you know, caste is a big deal, a big problem. And Brahmins are known as the twice born. Not only if they had their ordinary birth, but through being given the thread at a certain age, when they became of a certain age, they'd be twice born as gods. But Shantideva is saying, well, no, the real rebirth, the real lineage you need to connect up with, the real kula that you need to be part of, is that of the Buddha kula. You need to become a son of the Buddha and then behave according to the traditions of that family. Interestingly enough, Dr. Ambedkar, at the time of his conversion, in his great 22 vows, one of the vows was, "I feel that I am having a spiritual rebirth." So even in modern Buddhism, as it were, there's this continuation of this idea that there's a real kind of rebirth, a real a profound change as you enter more deeply into the Buddhist life, although he saw that as in terms of becoming a Buddhist. So with the arising of the bodhicitta, we have a completely different approach to life. Whereas before, we're living for ourselves, everything revolving around ourselves, now we're living for others. We're living from wisdom and love. There's a shift of emphasis, a revolution in consciousness, a turning around. I really liked last night what Arthur Priya was saying about circumambulating the stupa. It's a practice of selflessness. We're not revolving around ourselves when we circumambulate the stupa. We revolve around the bodhicitta, actually, because Dada Rinpoche, you could say, is an embodiment of bodhicitta. I really liked what Arthur Priya said there. But how does this arising of the bodhicitta come about? I want to go into that. Of course, Bhante's written about this a lot in that Awakening of the Bodhi Heart. He talks about the sevenfold puja as a way of the bodhicitta arising, performance of the puja. And we're doing that practice, of course, in the evenings, or we will be. He also gives Vasubandhu's four factors for the arising of the bodhicitta. And there's lots of, you know, in a way, all our practice is to do with the arising of the bodhicitta, if we focus it properly. But I want to go into it today, the arising of the bodhicitta, by looking more closely at the bodhicitta itself. I want to do that by reflecting a little on a phrase, actually originally a long Sanskrit compound, that the great Indian teacher Atisha, who was kind of headed a great movement of renewal in Tibetan Buddhism, Atisha and his disciples were very fond of using to describe the goal of the Buddha's teachings. No doubt it's derived from Indian sources. The Sanskrit, the great long Sanskrit compound, is Shunyata Karuna Garbha. Shunyata Karuna Garbha, which means the essence of voidness and compassion, or the essence of emptiness and compassion. So this is a way of describing the goal of the teaching. It's a way of describing the bodhicitta, the essence of voidness and compassion. And on one occasion, Atisha's main disciple, Geshe Drom, was asked by one of his own disciples, what is the essence of all the paths to Buddhahood? You can imagine the situation. If you were a Tibetan at that time, there was probably lots of different teachings flowing in from India, all sorts of different sadhanas and practices. Well, what to practice? What's the thing you should do? And of course, it's even perhaps worse for us. You know, we have our wonderful bookshop, but you know, if you were to read just a few of those books, you'd think, well, what should I do? What's the goal of the teaching? Anyway, Geshe Drom replied to his disciples, although there are an inconceivable number of precepts, there is only one thing to be obtained. And so what is that one thing? The possession of the essence of voidness and compassion. Let me explain, says Geshe Drom. Voidness is the absolute bodhicitta. It is the realization that all phenomena are by nature without truly existent birth. Compassion is the relative bodhicitta. It is the great compassion extended to all living beings who have not yet realized fundamental birthlessness. So if you want to generate bodhicitta, this is what we have to do. We have to work simply on two things at the same time, as it were. We need to be looking to cultivate a profound insight into awareness of all things. Drom speaks of this as realizing the birthlessness of all things. This is really another way of saying emptiness, that there are no separate things and people in reality. Voidness, emptiness here means the absence of self and other, the absence of, if you like, distinctions between things, seeing that there's no self-nature anywhere. So we need to be working on that, and we need to be cultivating compassion for all beings. All very simple, these two things. But how on earth can we actually relate to this? It can all seem so very distant. Actually, it's quite exciting here, that word birthlessness, and you know, you want to go away and reflect on it, and that's a good thing. But I think we really do need to try and make all this stuff more accessible, more immediately apparent to us, without, I hope, the loss of depth and profundity. What does it mean for us now to begin to cultivate the essence of voidness and compassion? And yesterday I was really bothered about this. I actually wrote a great long talk, which I dumped because I thought, no, this isn't it. So I was kind of, you know, a bit bothered yesterday. Well, you know, what are we doing? In very simple language. And something popped up, not original at all, but nonetheless it popped up. What we're doing, I think, can be summed up in the word openness. Or opening. It's very, very simple what we're trying to do. We're trying to open. Entering the Bodhisattva path is stepping into openness. Getting rid of all complexity, it's about opening up, opening the heart. Just opening. Actually, opening's rather a lovely image, and you know, it is one of those terms you find a lot in modern books on Buddhism about the importance of opening and opening up. But it's actually really a lovely word. You know, just reflect. opening a door is actually a rather lovely thing to do, isn't it? When you open a door, you're moving into from one space into another. Or you, if you're in the forest, in the woods, and you the path is all tangled over, or there's a lot of undergrowth, and then you see an opening. It's exciting, that opening. There's a sense of freedom and space. And sometimes, you know, applying that to our own experience, we can be very confused and lost and tangled. And then there's a kind of opening, you know, there's a kind of space that opens up. We can sort of see a way through. And that's a very thrilling moment. To enter the Bodhisattva path, we have to open up to the way things are. It's described, yes, as shunyata, as voidness and all that. But it's more a case at first of just opening up to what's actually going on. Opening up to especially the changing, elusive nature of things. Opening up to that fact. We don't have to be metaphysical about shunyata and get lost in, you know, the dialectics of Buddhist philosophy. First and foremost, it's about opening up simply to the fact that things change and that they're elusive. We so want life to be a certain way, a particular way. We want other people to be a certain way for us, for our benefit. You know, we might say, well, no, I want it for them. But actually, we want them to be a certain way for our benefit. Now, that's not bad. It's not evil to be like that. In a way, we have to be like that to get anywhere in life, to survive. And in a way, we have to be like that to practice the Dharma, to kind of get anything going and do something to benefit other people. We need to make effort and apply ourselves, of course. But at the same time, very importantly, we have to cultivate this openness to whatever actually arises. Life, other people, won't conform to what we want. They won't and they don't. They might for a bit, it might all seem to fit together very, very well, very nicely. But actually, it's all going to break down. It's all going to shift and change. This even happens within ourselves. We have all sorts of expectations and ideas about how we should be. I told you how, after I was ordained, I thought a couple of years, bodhicitta, sailing along nicely. Well, I was very, very rudely awakened very, very quickly after that. You know, the messages started to come through. Look, baby, this spiritual life isn't going to be like that. It took me a long time to actually, you know, sort of take that on. Even with the spiritual life, we, you know, what we're doing with it is we're trying to actually make life safe. It's very interesting reading Bhante's recent reporting in into Shabda and a letter that went round. And, you know, he was saying, you know, he'd kind of accepted death, but old age was something he hadn't quite bargained for. And, you know, when his eyes went and then his sleep went, suddenly he went from, you know, a fairly good, late middle age, suddenly into old age. And it was very, very difficult. And, you know, he described his practice of dealing with that, of responding to that. And he wrote very, very movingly about that. Things break down, things change, things move on. Life is groundless. There is no ground, actually, to stand on. The Perfection of Wisdom literature, they often use this metaphor. There's often this question, where do bodhisattvas stand? It's great, they keep asking this question. Where do bodhisattvas stand? How do they stand? It's interesting, this idea of standing somewhere, this image of standing somewhere. And of course they say, bodhisattvas don't stand anywhere. They don't stand in form, they don't stand in feeling, they don't stand in any of the skandhas, because they know that these skandhas are in themselves empty. There's nowhere to stand, and that's how they stand. Standing is no standing, that's why it's standing. And yet, bodhisattvas are incredibly active, intensely involved with others. It doesn't mean, you know, sometimes I think this, you know, the wrong interpretation of perfection of wisdom literature and all the material that can go with that can result in a kind of quietism, that real practice is not actually engaging with anything. Well, that's I think that's a real cop-out, really. If you don't engage, you won't discover how not to stand somewhere. So we need to open. We need to open up to actual experience, to what is actually happening. Not what we think should be happening, but what is actually happening. And in the Bodhisattva path, they kind of relish the experiences of becoming groundless. They're treasured very, very highly. We'll look into that when we look at Kshanti Paramita. We'll have a good look at all the examples they give of being made groundless. You know, we'll look at betrayal. You know, if you're betrayed, that's a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful thing if you're betrayed, if people let you down, people who you've loved and they treat you badly. They say that's wonderful because you're going to experience groundlessness. Difficult people, fantastic. Your best friends, because you've got no ground to stand on. You can't just get into a groove with them. You're always being tripped up. So they really love that. It's annoying. The way they kind of relish these things. But it's obvious what they're doing. They say these experiences of becoming groundless are tremendously important, tremendously rich. If you like, there are all sorts of little deaths that can happen throughout the day, throughout our lives. And of course, there is always the presence of impermanence and the big death, if you like, that's around us. Life is groundless. Our ground goes, suddenly we're not standing anywhere. And of course, the result of that, when it happens, the effect can be one of anxiety and panic and fear and dread. But there's a great wisdom in this, great possibility here. It can be very painful, very confusing, very upsetting, even humiliating. But it said there's a great wisdom possible in all this. If we can open to it, we are being given the possibility of discovering voidness and emptiness. Bhante once said, I think this is in his lecture, A System of Meditation, in talking about meditations on shunyata, he says that sometimes we can go through periods in our spiritual life where we experience a great nameless kind of primordial fear. And he says, well, that could be the breath of shunyata, the breath of emptiness. We're opening up to the insubstantial nature, the impermanent nature of things. And very often the stories of great teachers and their disciples are stories of the teacher destroying people's expectations, creating groundlessness, so that you're sort of thrown back on yourself, on life, if you like. I remember, you know, I should have guessed what was coming very, very early on when the first time I met Bhante. I was sitting with Bhante in this tiny little room in Brighton. He'd stayed the night, and he was there the next day, and he was just sitting there. And Bhante in those days was quite strange to be around in some ways. If he didn't want to talk, he just didn't talk. He just sort of sat there, and he wasn't making conversation. He wasn't putting me at my ease particularly. Long, lank black hair and rough looking clothes. And we were sitting there drinking tea, and he suddenly leaned over and picked up an incense stick and started to clean his ears with it, which I found completely horrifying. My first thought, well, God, what would my mother say? Which is a real giveaway, isn't it? But in a way, it was a good start, I think, in terms of, he was just being himself. But I think it was a good start in terms of, don't expect, your teacher, your spiritual friend, to be neat and tidy. He's not going to fit in with your expectations of what a spiritual man should be. So we need to open up to the groundlessness of things, open up to experience. And of course, meditation is incredibly important here. Regular meditation and spending time in retreat, really getting into mindfulness of breathing and developing calm and peace and tranquility. And metta, very, very important, you know, to open up to what's happening. There needs to be a lot of warmth, a lot of love surrounding it all. And devotion and faith, this is where puja comes in. There needs to be all that richness going on. And of course, spiritual friends and dharma study. You know, when things are kind of falling apart like that, if we've studied the Dharma, taken the Dharma into us, it means we've got at least some ideas which we can bring to bear on our experience. It creates some kind of context. Above all, to make sense of all this, for opening to take place, we need to go for refuge. We need to make a deep spiritual commitment to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. They need to be at the centre of our lives. It's going to be very hard to open up in this way if there isn't some, you know, integration around our spiritual ideals, which going for refuge represents. All this, all these things, you could generally put under the heading of shamatha. All these things I've mentioned create the ground out of which you can open up to the groundlessness of things, to the insubstantiality of things. This is something that you start to do intensively before your ordination, and after ordination you carry on doing it with the meditation on the six elements, the six element practice, very, very important practice. You meditate on the fact that you don't have a separate self. So the Buddhist path, like the Bodhisattva path, the Buddhist path generally, is a truly heroic path. Because it's a path of complete honesty. You're true, because you're going to be true to what is actually going on. You're going to be true to the fact that everything is insubstantial and ever-changing. You're going to be true to experience. And it's heroic to open up to that. It's a battle to open up to that. There's so much of us that doesn't want to open up to that. There's so much in people around us that doesn't want to open up to that. So there's a real fight that goes on. I see this in myself. Notice how irritated I get when others, you know, don't behave as I think they should. Well, that's a dead giveaway. You know, as I think they should. You know, that's, you know, resisting. Just change. It's just not opening up to experience. Or distraction. You know, that is a way of avoiding experience, you know, overeating, sex fantasies, sleep, sloth, entertainment. I say entertainment rather than, you know, being, you know, profoundly involved in culture. Entertainment. It's often avoidance of what is actually happening, of what's going on. Ultimately, this opening up to experience is about dying, spiritually dying. Shantideva speaks of the arising of the bodhicitta resulting in spiritual rebirth, but there's no rebirth without spiritual death. There's no spiritual rebirth without spiritual death. He also speaks of the bodhicitta as the quicksilver elixir, the mercury of the alchemist, that transfigures our ordinary, our base form, into the golden Buddha form. But in alchemy, part of the transformation process, the transmutation process, involves the phase known as nigredo, or blackening. Blackening. The base metal is burned and blackened, turned into ashes. There is a dying away. Shantideva also likens the bodhicitta to the great fire that destroys the world at the end of the eon. It's that powerful, that intense. It will burn us. So there'll be times in our spiritual life which will seem black. We will feel burned and bruised. There'll be times of fear and confusion as we let go of our usual ways of ordering the world and as we open up to the impermanent and elusive nature of things. And of course, This opening up will happen whether we're conscious of it or not. If we seriously engage in Buddhist practice, on some level we're actually opening up to the transformative nature of things. So it might be a good idea to get conscious of that going on. So often we approach the spiritual life in terms of, well, I'll do these practices and they'll have a nice effect on me, but we still got this idea that we're sort of going through them and we're going to come out the other side more or less the same, just a sort of better version. It's not going to be like that. So this is why Sangha is so important, not just as a support for us in terms of spiritual friendship, but in a more profound way as the alembic, the crucible in which our bodhicitta, our opening, takes place. Our attempt to raise the bodhicitta takes place. Sangha, particularly as we envisage it, as something intensive, as intensive interaction, and Sangha as we envisage it as something expanding and opening up to more and more people. Sangha is so important as a practice because we are brought up against other people, different people, different from us, changing people. And you can't, if you're part of a genuine spiritual community, just arrange things according to your convenience. You can't do that. You can try, but it won't work. The Sangha is important for this, as part of this process of opening up to changing experience, to the elusive nature of things. This fact that we're being transformed through practice can also make us, in a way, it can make the Dharma threatening. It can make the Dharma appear threatening, especially to close friends and family who don't practice. They can sense the change, the transformation going on in you, and they experience that loss of ground as very frightening. It can happen, actually, with other members of the Sangha. You know, we might be changing, other people might be changing, and that can be very threatening. So a true Sangha needs to have this openness to this profound change going on. So we can begin to approach the voidness, the emptiness aspect of bodhicitta through simply opening up to experience. Watch what is actually going on. Look at those petals falling to the ground, those beautiful rose petals in the rose walk, you know, which are being bashed and hammered by the rain, and the way those beautiful rose blooms just, you know, drop their petals into the mud. Or really take that in. Look at the clouds forming and dissolving. Look at your breath. That breath is so impermanent. It's so tenuous. It's so elusive. A reflect on aging, the fact that we're getting old. You know, every time I look in the mirror, my hair just seems to be getting whiter and whiter. So what about the compassionate aspect of bodhicitta? The compassionate end of it, so to speak, of shunyata, Karinagarbha. I have to confess that I am, in fact, increasingly uneasy with the word compassion. It trips off the tongue so easily and so readily, but it all too easily becomes sentimentalized. Real compassion is intensely practical, intensely selfless. But so often... Oh dear. Lost the page. Okay. Yes, real compassion is intensely practical. Somebody with real compassion, they really do get involved with people and help them to alleviate their suffering. But I think very often compassion... for us, is an idea of compassion. Or it can be feeling sad at the suffering of others. But you feel sort of good about feeling sad. about the suffering of others. You like that kind of feeling of pity. It's a sort of something you can groove on, but it doesn't actually mean that you do anything. Or if you do something, you make a right mess of it. Or you end up being condescending towards other people. You help people, but you also look down on them. You have a status. You're standing somewhere in relation to them. This is not the compassion of the Buddha or a great Bodhisattva. They don't stand anywhere, remember that. Their compassion, therefore, is unself-conscious, natural, practical, and without sentiment, even sometimes tough and no-nonsense. When you read the lives of the Chan masters, the Zen masters, they can often seem very, very fierce, and they're very, very critical about what they call grandmotherly compassion, where, you know, people just make other people comfortable because they want to feel comfortable themselves. One of the best, depictions of compassion that I've come across is in a film by Kurosawa called Redbeard. If you ever get a chance to see it. It's about a doctor. And there's this completely unsentimental compassion and active compassion, alleviating suffering, and understanding why people are the way they are, and completely clean, no nonsense, practical, that horrible sort of cloying sentimentality, but genuine warmth, ordinary warmth, wonderful depiction, I think, well worth seeing. So we need to begin in a very ordinary sort of way, I feel, if we're going to approach compassion. We need to start off with just ordinary things, with the cultivation, very simply, of friendliness and kindness, with loving kindness. So yes, metta-bhavana. Metta-bhavana. We need to begin with metta-bhavana in a very, very ordinary way, developing some warmth and friendliness to people. Yes, we can go on to the other Brahma-viharas if we want. Compassion and joy and equanimity. In fact, in the early Mahayana sutras, these practices, the Brahma-viharas, actually constitute the bodhicitta. These emotions add up to the bodhicitta. And it's very interesting. I was looking at a book by somebody called Jan Natter, I think her name is. And it's a study of an early Mahayana sutra, which has been overlooked by modern scholars. And she points out that in this sutra, the emphasis is on Maitri. It's on metta. It's on friendliness. It's on loving kindness. That's the emphasis on the person who becomes the bodhisattva, rather than compassion. And she even points out that compassion lends itself to the idea of, as it were, looking down on people, whereas, you know, metta, maitri, is just straightforward friendliness. And Bhante himself has laid great emphasis on metta as a practice. Metta more, perhaps, than, compassion. And he points out that the other emotion arise from that naturally. If you develop metta, it will turn into compassion when you encounter suffering. It will turn into sympathetic joy if you encounter the happiness of others. It will turn into equanimity when you feel love evenly for all. It will turn into reverence when you encounter people more experienced than you. So metta, maitri, friendliness, is the basic positive open response to other people. So it's no use going on about wisdom and compassion and all that sort of thing if we're deficient in metta, if we're deficient in ordinary friendliness. And it's why the metta-bhavana, the five-stage metta-bhavana, is so very, very important. I really do think that going through the stages, I find it's really, really crucial to do that. People say, oh, it's just a preliminary practice, you know, that you need to move on quickly to insight practice. But I find that the metta-bhavana is actually an insight practice because it reveals to me my dualistic mind. If I'm You know, in that practice, if I have preferences, I'm in a dualistic state. You know, it's showing me how, you know, how dualistic I am. If there's people I dislike that I'm indifferent to, people I like better than others, well, there's no insight. That's a direct reflection of my understanding. So I think it's very, very important, the five-stage metta-bhavana. If there's people you're having difficulties with, you need to look at that. You need to confront that. You need to start developing metta towards them. And Bhante believes that you can go all the way with metta-bhavana. In fact, in the Karaniya Metta Sutta, this is pointed out, you can go all the way. If you really dwell in metta, if you really develop metta as fully, as deeply as you can go all the way. You can arrive at insight. If we dwell in metta, we might begin to understand what compassion really is, what it actually is. So we approach bodhicitta by opening up to others, by opening up to life generally, and we open up to others, to everyone we meet, through cultivating what some Mahayana texts call the great loving heart. And again, this is an incredibly heroic thing to do, to soften like that, to open up with love and friendliness to others. It's an incredibly heroic thing to do. The world is a very harsh and brutal and violent place. It's not like that here, but it is like that in many places. The world also can be a very, very cynical place. Now, I was listening to some discussions on the radio the other day by some academics talking about religion, and they were talking actually about Western Buddhism and Western Buddhists in a way that I found just incredibly cynical. Incredibly cynical, sort of dismissing it, dismissing Western Buddhism as lightweights. And I just thought, wow, you know. And so assured in what they were saying. They weren't talking about the Western Buddhist order, just Western Buddhists in general. And they made some very good points, but I thought, wow, you know, this is a very strange thing to be listening to. And people can be cynical about people who devote themselves to the development of love, to opening up the heart, to doing that genuinely without sentiment. So we could be, in following this path, opening up to experience, opening up to others, we could be opening ourselves to ridicule, even to manipulation. We could be opening ourselves to disappointment. We might love others, you know, really working on loving others and being kind to others, generous to others, and then they turn away from us, or they take advantage of us, or they, you know, they just have a reaction to us. That's extremely painful. But someone who enters the Bodhisattva path just... what's happening? Just does that. They just carry on. And yes, it is a heroic... It is a genuinely heroic act to open up in this way. So I'm feeling quite heroic, wondering what's happened to my notes right now. This is great because it's obviously the groundlessness of things. But phew, I knew there was a teaching in here somewhere. Anyway, no wonder the Bodhisattva is described as a great hero or a great warrior. So giving rise to the bodhicitta involves opening up to experience, to the elusive, ever-changing, insubstantial, groundless nature of life. It means opening up to the possibility of standing nowhere. It involves opening up to others, expanding the heart through friendliness and loving kindness. And of course, it sounds so easy and relaxed talking like this, unless you've mixed your notes up. But I'm sure you all realise that it isn't like that. It's a very intensive process, this. If we're serious, if we really do resonate with the Bodhisattva ideal, it's not a game for us. It's real, and that's intensive. Entering this path, the Bodhicharya, which is another word for the Dharmacharya, which is what a Dharmachari does, will not be neat and tidy. We will encounter conflicts and tensions. Conflict and tension between the real and the ideal, for example. We're called to a life of wisdom and love. But there's so much in us that's just not like that. that's just so out of touch with that. And that creates incredible tension in us, and we want to make that tension go away. Sometimes we do that by invoking a sort of spurious non-duality, doing a kind of intellectual conjuring trick, you know, whereby we say, well, it's non-dual, man, you know, it's all Buddha nature. But you can't really do that. Our response to bodhicitta is like grit in the oyster. It's an irritant. And irritants you know, cause discomfort. But that irritant creates the pearl. That creates the pearl of the bodhicitta. There's a conflict too between that desire, that very real desire, that need for a calm, undistracted and vibrant mind. You know, the sort of mind that you develop on retreat, and you can feel yourself going deeper and deeper and deeper. You know, it's really important that you have that. But then there are the needs of other people. On retreat, you sort of find it's fairly easy, it's fairly straightforward, it all seems to flow along. But then there are our family members, our community members, our business, our centre. Sometimes we feel that we're being pulled in two directions at once. We're pulled, as it were, away from the world. But we're also wanting to respond to other people, so we're pulled towards the world more intensively. In the Survey of Buddhism, in his section on the arising of the bodhicitta, Bhante said that is precisely what a bodhisattva or an aspirant bodhisattva does. That's exactly how he generates bodhicitta. The aspirant bodhisattva, the ideal aspirant bodhisattva, creates in himself two contradictory forces. Very, very powerfully he sets up these forces. He reflects and meditates on the unsatisfactoriness of the world, reflects on the lakshanas, reflects on the need for renunciation. He moves away from the world. At the same time, he develops an intense love and compassion for others. So he moves towards the world. So he's setting up these two contradictory forces. These forces collide, and out of that collision arises the jewel of the bodhicitta. This is what he says. So don't think necessarily that something is wrong when you encounter conflict and tension within yourself. It could be a success. It could be that you've arrived at a point of some progress when you come across two contradictory forces in yourself. Even if it's just the tension between seeing the ideal male clearly, where you would like to be and where you are. That's an achievement, to see that dichotomy, to have that tension. If it's always easy and smooth, maybe you're not being fully honest with yourself and not being fully honest and fully true to Buddhist tradition, to your own ideals even. And again, this is why Sangha is so very important. Yes, we need the support and help from spiritual friends, but as I've also said, the Sangha is the alchemist's alembic and crucible. This is where the great work of transformation occurs. The real Sangha is a crucible of intensive interaction with other people very different from ourselves. Sometimes within the Sangha, I certainly feel this within our Sangha, within our Arhuta, the only thing in common I have with some other people is simply our common go for refuge, our spiritual aspiration. In the normal course of life, if I hadn't become a Buddhist, I would not be with these people. I would not be in the same room with them. They seem weird, strange, annoying, irritating. And of course, I can be like that to other people. Let's be clear, this is what it's like. And especially it can be like this in times of difficulty and change. But this is precisely why we have Sangha. Precisely why. Because it's showing us exactly where we are, and these tensions that arise, this is the crucible. This is the crucible in which the bodhicitta can arise. I found this happening very intensively recently with all the kind of changes going on and lots of debate and discussion in the order, and you know, some of the things that I've found people, order members, saying have really shocked me. And I've had some, you know, real moments of disappointment and annoyance at other people's views, and even wondering, well, why bother? Why bother at all? Why don't I just go off with me mates and we'll do it just on our own? Of course, you think that through and you think, well, yeah, but you'll just start another Sangha and people will come along who look fantastic and then they'll change and they'll be saying the same things that actually these people who are actually really trying to get to the truth of things themselves are doing. You're just going to... You can't do that, actually. I did have some help from my friends pointing this out. What I in fact realised in this period, what also started to come through, was, and it's interesting, I just about how our Sangha was, I wasn't quite independently, friends of mine were thinking the same thoughts and heading in the having the same sort of intuition as myself, even though we hadn't talked about that. But what I realised was needed was a deeper vision of the order, a much deeper vision of what we were doing, and a deeper, bigger consciousness myself. And that could only be bodhicitta. That could only be bodhicitta. Because the bodhicitta is characterised by a love, a friendliness, and yes, let's call it a compassion, that stands on nothing, that's not dependent on reward, or people liking you, or people agreeing with you. It's a love and a compassion, a spiritual aspiration that is really the outpouring of the voidness. For a bodhisattva, it seems, all the work he does, all the difficulty, is just the natural expression of life. And I aspire to this. I aspire to this standing on nothing that the bodhisattva has, this love and friendliness that stands nowhere. I'm feeling, actually, a long way out of my depth now. I really am. And I think I'm going to leave the last words to Bhante, a poem, in fact, written in 1950. Actually, I think it's one of his very best. It's very, very simple. But I think it sort of sums up where I, and I know many others, want to be. It's called The Unseen Flower. Compassion is far more than emotion. It is something that springs up in the emptiness, which is when you yourself are not there, so that you do not know anything about it. Nobody, in fact, knows anything about it. If they knew it, it would not be compassion. But they can only smell the scent of the unseen flower that blooms in the heart of the void.